And this is where I disagree with the bridge, like the whole bridge building emphasis in our culture. It's hard to, like, how do you come out against bridge building? But there are some people in our culture who don't, who aren't interested and don't want you to be bridging to them.
There is a what point do? Where that strategy becomes outright naive.
Welcome to What in God's Name? She is Shayna Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
We are the podcast of the S1 Project. Our mission is to practice and promote moral conversations using the lenses of moral philosophy and theology to see more deeply into our shared common life.
To use those narratives to lift us beyond the binaries of politics and economics, which define so much of the conversation we share in the public square, but which do little to ground us in the higher aspirations of human thriving.
Check out our work and developing projects at s1project.org. Hey, Shayna, do you say, when you're reading a website like this, do you say s1project.org or do you say s1project.org?
.org.
Oh, well, I said it .org.
That's okay. I think our listeners know how to put the letters together. They're a pretty smart crew.
We have a spinny wheel. It is a bicycle wheel mounted on a piece of plywood. The piece of plywood has painted on it into the form of wedges. It's like pieces of a pie. There are 16 different sections, and the spinny wheel can land on one of those 16 different core values and key ideas. Shayna and I do a riff on the one thing that it landed on, so it's spontaneous. We don't know where it's going to land, and we do a riff. It's improv. I love a little improv. It gets us warmed up to do our show.
And the rest of the show, which is also improv.
We're demonstrating conversation, which is
fluid
conversation.
Fluid.
Yes, conversation understood as improvisational, which is listening and receiving what the other is putting forward and responding with the yes. And
yes, and
sometimes no, but I think it's my turn to give it a spin.
Go ahead, Chris, give it a whirl. And for our listeners who are listening today and cannot see us yet, because we haven't established the technology to actually broadcast ourselves live, though that could happen one day, but then we'd have to, you know, clean up before the show. My podcast partner, Chris, took it upon himself to get a haircut at some point in this past week. And I have to tell you guys, he looks pretty dashing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, of course. And the add-on, the yes and to
yes
that
and.
One is I also washed my hair.
So he is,
hey,
yes,
hey,
he is.
How about that?
If ever it was a day we were going to live stream, this would have been it. Go ahead, Chris, give the wheel a spin.
The spinny wheel has landed on cultural narrative therapy. We haven't landed on that in a while, Shayna. What our show is about, our project, the S1 Project, is about is telling deeper stories. I mean, these lenses of moral philosophy and theology, our hypothesis, one of our axioms is that using that lens can help us see deeper. Another way to talk about seeing deeper is to tell a deeper story or tell a more interesting story about our shared common life than what we get with narrow partisan political stories or economic stories. So that's it. Cultural narrative therapy. Our culture needs to tell better stories, more interesting stories about, you know why? Partly why is because of our humanity, and we talk about human flourishing. The lenses of politics and economics flatten humanity, and the cultural narrative therapy, more interesting stories.
Stories, because yeah. I don't find much of the political blather taking place out there simply shares a point of view or perspective and opinion, but it doesn't tell a story. And I mean, storytelling is such an intimate part of human existence. We've been telling stories for, human beings have been using stories for, you know, thousands upon thousands of years to to try to understand the meaning of life and our role in it. Storytelling can break down barriers. Storytelling invites us into intimate places in one another's lives so that we can see one another more fully rather than just see the opinions that a person holds.
Thank you for that. I feel like I want to land here for a second because that's so interesting. I want to pursue this for a second. So if I think of the S1 Project and the stories that we're interested in, I mean, one is, I'm curious if you agree or how you would yes and on this one, but our project has to do with our shared common life, the United States. So if I think of the big story, that's U.S. history and trying to understand where we are now within the larger story of American democracy, which is, interestingly enough, a contested story. So part of our work is participating in the contest to argue for a particular way of understanding how the story is unfolding. I'm saying that as I listen to myself, I know that sounds abstract. And indeed, I think one of our challenges is to try to make that more and more concrete. The other thing, you know, for our theologically inclined and open listeners, and this can sound threatening to those who are not theologically inclined, but I mean, the biblical account is a story about God's involvement and love for the world. And so when we put on our theological hats, that's the big, like, there's a big cosmic story there too that has drama, that has conflict, that we're not sure is going to get resolved. We don't know how it's going to play out, and that's part of the suspense of a story. Curious if you have any responses to that.
Yeah, I think, you know, how we tell the story or how we even hold stories, you know, with respect to U.S. history, what is the lens? We talk a lot on the show about lenses. What are the lenses that we choose to read history through, in the same way that we choose lenses through which we read scriptures?
Yeah.
Some of us read for liberation, right? We read for, we've chosen that because we know we're going to interpret. So being able to take responsibility for your interpretation means you also take responsibilities for the ways in which you may miss some things.
Yeah.
That is what enables us, in fact motivates us, to be in conversation with others, because we know our perspectives are limited. And so one of the things that we do here at the S1 Project is encourage that self-awareness, because it is out of that self-awareness that a real organic interest emerges to hear, to both be aware of perspectives that are not contained in our own or that are not being lifted up in the telling of a story, and then to listen very carefully, you know, to the people who are lifting those up, or, you know, to seek out those stories, which is so important in creating balance. So I think, yeah, it's stories are critical. Stories are how we understand our world, and I think some of the confusion and chaos we're experiencing right now has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, the stories contained in scriptures are simply, you know, I think it was Rabbi Kushner said, the Bible will always tell you more about the people who wrote it than it will about God. You know, it was people's efforts to try to figure stuff out and as best as they were able. We've got different tools available to us today in different contexts, but the questions we're asking are often the same. So it's nice to be able to reflect on, well, how were people wrestling with that a few thousand years ago? So yeah, we could stay on this and do a whole show about this, but it actually is good background though for where we are going in today's show. So hold on to what you've heard thus far, listeners, and stand by for a brief transition. That is the tone that indicates the brief transition.
I just want, you know, I sounded the tone for the brief transition, but I'm circling back just to say we could have continued on that. Sometimes I feel like we should spin the wheel and just do the whole show on whatever it lands on, but
we could so easily do that.
Our main idea today is that the S1 project presented at Tufts University at the Tisch School for Civic Life, their conference called Frontiers of Democracy, and the theme of this year's Frontiers of Democracy conference at Tufts is violence, nonviolence, and robust democracy. So what I'm going to do, Shana, is talk to you about the presentation that I made on behalf of the S1 project. And the spirit of the presentation was not for me to get up and give a long lecture and make a sustained argument. And I explained this to the participants in our workshop right up front. The purpose was to offer some provocations, some principles, some axioms as a provocation for conversation. Because conversation really is central to who we are and what we do at the S1 project. So
you use the word provocation as opposed to invitation, and I'm curious about that.
Interesting. Provocation, oh man, I love the question. And immediately in my mind's eye, I thought of sand and oyster. So
the sand is an irritant.
It's an irritant, and from it, around it is formed
the pearl. Okay. Wow. Wow. That's beautiful. Okay. Good answer. Moving on. Okay, give me the glass. Moving on.
Yeah. Yes. Provocation in a way like that.
Generative.
In a way like that.
Yeah.
Generative.
A mildly irritating, but ultimately life-giving.
It's okay. A great metaphor.
It and is
I
a
haven't
great
I haven't actually thought of that in a long time. So I was grateful for your questioning of that. So, Shana, we've talked about this, and so basically, the first provocation is something you know, and that we've talked about, and that is the moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy are not ensured by the practice of democracy. Now, this has been a theme for us this year. Part of the reason it's a central hypothesis of the S1 project is because it names up front that there is a moral dimension and that there are moral norms. And it's interesting to present this provocation, this principle, this statement to people because they scratch their heads a little bit at first. And it's partly because of the way it's worded. It's worded almost like a riddle. So you have to pause and think about it. And so I'll say it one more time. And then what I'd like to do is offer a couple of examples of the moral norms.
Doesn't that make it like an aphorism?
Thank you.
It's sort of an aphorism.
It's aphoristic.
It's like you have to, and the more you think about it, the more your head wants to explode, like in a good way, opening.
Exactly. But, yeah. So the moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy are not ensured by the practice of democracy. So in other words, there are moral norms. There are moral norms that according to this aphorism, if it's true, there are moral norms that have to be shared in the culture and have to be developed in the individual that are prior to the exercise of democracy, and that just because we practice democracy doesn't mean that those moral norms will continue to be formed in individuals and held by the wider society.
And therein the problem lies.
Therein the problem lies. So I'm just going to give you two examples because, again, my mind works philosophically. It's easy for me to stay in abstraction. I don't like to because I want to give people a way to connect to these abstract ideas. So two thoughts about what is a moral norm for the practice of democracy. One is when you lose, you accept losing. And the moral dimension...
Amen.
Okay, so the moral dimension of this, you could say that and not think of it as a moral dimension. You could think of it as it's customary. It usually happens that. That's the way we have gone on over time. And that's not... There's a moral dimension to that, but it's not thickly moral. It's just custom. This is just what we do. So what I'm suggesting is something deeper.
Until we don't.
Until we don't. Exactly. And then you need to remember the moral dimension. Why do we do this? Why is that a good?
Right.
Why ought we to continue that practice? And thank you for saying that, because that you just actually gave me chills. Because that's exactly the point. And the thicker description, I believe, is that the practice of democracy, for it to work, has to, the moral dimension of this, of losing, is that you're willing to put yourself second and put the process first, put the process ahead of you. And so there's the moral dimension of that is, in a way, it's self-sacrifice.
It is in every way. And I think, you know, when we've talked about the number of places in society today that are being riddled, actually bullet ridden, you know, where people claim personal rights, but do so without also holding responsibility for how their exercise of their freedoms is impacting others. So then it becomes all about the individual, and then we end up with in this toxic individualism, which we've talked about on the show before. It is almost like, I love this topic, I love that cornerstone on which the S1 project is built, because it's like those moral norms are the safety net and the bowl, you know, that holds democracy. Those moral norms are the flame which gives it both warmth and light. I mean, the moral norms are fundamental. The sine qua non, is that the Latin, the thing which is essential that cannot be done without. Unfortunately, right now we are all living in a time where those moral norms have been so shattered, and where so few institutions are doing the work of building up citizens. We've talked about this extensively on the show, that fiber is missing from our democracy. And so our democracy right now is staggering. It is weak. It is lackluster. And it is under threat of being completely obliterated. Yeah. I mean, that's how, I'm rarely this assertive, I think, but I just think that statement is inarguable. It is what is so. To me, it doesn't land as abstract at all.
So as part of the conversation that we generated at the Tufts Frontiers of Democracy conference, I had a great conversation with a woman who thinks a lot about democracy and tends to think about it in terms of structural reforms, things like ranked choice voting. And we didn't get into an argument because she was smart enough, and I'm smart enough at this point in my life, to see the complementarity mm-hmm. between the structural reforms that need to happen and the cultural, moral dimension. So we had a really interesting conversation because, you know, some people's cast of mind will go to the structural things. We need to do the structural reforms. And I mean, it's trite to say, and I said this to her in the conversation, it's trite to say it's both, but it is a both and.
It's a both and, yep. And there was the sand in the clam, boy, because it provoked a conversation that, just hearing you talk about the conversation widens my thinking on the matter, because I never would have naturally gone to the structure. I would never have put the structural in there. But now that you mention it, it's like, oh yeah, no, that is a vital component of democracy. It's not exactly the thing that we're talking about. It isn't the moral substance, but for sure, without the structure, you know, a democratic structure, we have authoritarianism or some other hideous.
I just wanted to mention a second moral dimension of democracy, pertinent to giving concrete examples of this abstract aphorism that we've started with today, and this is quite simple but profound, I think, which is in a democracy you have to cultivate somehow the idea that the people you're with in the democracy that you disagree with are your friends, not your enemies. And so that's a moral outlook from our perspective. Oftentimes, I just take this little excursion for a second. Oftentimes when I talk about to people who don't know the S1 Project and I say that we look at the moral dimension, that the word moral lands very differently for different people. And I hasten to say we don't mean that as moralistic or puritanical, which is the way the word moral can land for some people.
It is the only way it lands for some people, which is why it is too easily and too often dismissed.
So to talk about your fellow citizens as friends rather than enemies is moral because it's about how we ought to be with one another. So there's the word ought in it that gives it a moral normative dimension, but it's also about a vision of human flourishing, which is how we talk about our show as well. We have obligations one to another. We need to cultivate certain attitudes towards one to another that allow for it, in a way, it's a little bit of a riff on the first moral dimension. It's a way to see the whole rather than self or mine or my tribe. So there's a moral dimension to it in that way.
Well, let me agree with you and then throw a little sand in the clam.
All right.
So my analogy is my competitor on the tennis court is not my enemy.
Yes. Right.
Good. A good competitor will bring out my best game.
Beautiful. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
If I'm in the right headset, if I'm a true competitor, then and not just someone out to win, but someone who's playing for the love of the game, then I want to be challenged. So, you know, in the case where you're having a conversation about the moral foundations necessary for a healthy democracy and somebody says, yeah, but it also needs structural stuff, like that person's not my enemy and they've expressed a point of view that's like, yes, that is a both and. Now the sand in the clam. We're living in a time where that is just not always possible. There is, as you know, I do work with New Hampshire Peace Action, and we provide peacekeepers for various rallies and so on and so forth. And there is this woman who keeps showing up, you know, at gay pride events or demonstrations up at the State House, and she is a conservative, hardcore Trumper, right-wing extremist,
If she's a Trumper, she's not a conservative, but carry on.
Correct. not in the true sense. That is absolutely correct. Because these guys had long ago lost the fundamentals. But she'll come in and she'll be, you know, videoing people. And, you know, the peacekeepers kind of try to keep the peace between her and the people who she agitates. And in fact, trying to keep her safe. Because if we weren't there, she probably would have gotten the shit knocked out of her on more than one occasion. But that is not a person you can speak with. That is not a person I can engage with. Still, even in that situation, okay, maybe this is not such a big wad of sand. So even in that situation, I always go back to something that Lao Tzu wrote in the Tao Te Ching. Lao Tzu was a contemporary of Confucius. And for listeners not familiar with the Tao Te Ching, it's basically a book of aphorisms which cause us to think deeply. At their core, the string that binds them together, I think, is I would say is something like everything at its extreme end becomes its opposite, and that's kind of a mind screw, but that you want a taste of the Tao. There it is. Lao Tzu wrote that what is a bad man, but a good man's teacher. So even in this time, you know, I can look at the behavior of some people and I can, you know, it teaches me how not to be. And she becomes my competitor because honestly, the temptation is when you're dealing with people like that is to get as obnoxious as they are. I mean, that's just, it's almost an organic response. Like I have to work hard at, you know, being kind in that situation. So, you know, so I suspect Lao Tzu is right. And even in that situation, you know, a bad person can be a good person's teacher.
Yeah. I'm grateful that you problematized the principle of friendship and enemy within a democratic polity because it needs problematized. And I don't think that we have thought this through as a culture at the moment. I mean, just to put a, see if I can put up.
Not only have we not thought it through, Chris, we have placed a value. People are getting rich being complete and total assholes.
Right, right. So there's that incentivized, absolutely. And that's part of what we're combating.
We've incentivized, S1 project. We've incentivized being a butthead.
Well, and creating enmity. Like if you have a platform
and you create enmity. Yep.
And that is, you know, from this perspective of a moral norm.
We've monetized it.
Right. From this perspective of a moral norm, that is.
Well, from the perspective of a moral norm, it says
it's shameful.
We value animosity.
Yep. So there's that. Thank you. And more pointedly, let's see if I can say this more pointedly. The problematized. Just speak English. The problem is those who are ready to reject democracy. So they've given up on the shared project of democratic norms. You know, January 6th. Okay, that's the paradigm. It's like okay, but so there's a cohort in our culture who wants to see enmity and create enemies and see our culture and our political life, our shared common life broadly, as divided between us and the enemy. And when that happens, what do we do? And that's just trying to make friends in that situation doesn't seem to be robust enough. Because
it's akin to bringing a fucking badminton racket to a rugby match.
Exactly.
You're gonna get your butt kicked.
Exactly.
Listen.
And this is where I disagree with the bridge, like the whole bridge building emphasis in our culture. It's hard to like, how do you come out against bridge building? But there are some people in our culture who aren't interested and don't want you to be bridging to them.
There is a
what
point where that strategy becomes outright naive. Yeah. So I want to say something about, so you categorized a group of people who have rejected democracy. Yeah. And I would challenge that because based on my understanding of their understanding, they don't understand democracy. And it's not even about democracy. It is about a cult affection for one individual that is leading them down a road. And it's terrifying because historically, of course, we've seen where this goes, you know, in the past. I don't even know if I would give them credit for having rejected democracy because I think...
You think they're just misguided?
I think...
Badly.
I'm going to say this, and this is arrogant as hell, and I'm going to own it, okay? I don't think they have the foggiest idea what democracy is. I think for them, democracy is all about individual rights. There is no we. There is just mine, for example, because democracy relies on the people, but it relies on the people being informed, educated, compassionate, and a collective, understanding themselves to be part of something bigger than just them. And I think by the time you get to, I think there's, you can't singularly categorize any group of people. And I think the folks who participated in the insurrection are no different. There were probably many different reasons why people were there, but ultimately not afraid to, feeling so angry, feeling so despairing that they just wanted to tear it all down, trusting that, I guess, I don't know, but trusting, I guess, that if they were successful in tearing it all down, then Donald Trump would be reinstalled and there would again be order in the kingdom. It, you know, people gravitate. They want a leader. They want a king. And for some people who have put their faith in Donald Trump, yes, you know, I don't think they really want what they're about to get. I don't know that they understand what they're buying, but it's not going to be pretty.
As you were speaking, I remembered this quote from John Adams, which I actually did write down in preparation for our conversation today. John Adams, okay, so late 18th century, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." Now, he says a moral and religious people, and you know, we can look back to the late 18th century. He means a very narrow element of this.
Yeah, I would simply
critique that, but we can expand
faithful.
It. Thank you. Exactly. The sentiment, the main idea, is, I think, correct. He was right.
And I would define, just to be clear for anybody who's confused, I would define that as the willingness to yield self to something greater, to the willingness to bind oneself to the mast of one's highest ideals and to engage in the practices necessary to remain there.
Yeah.
Against the call of the sirens.
Yeah. Yeah.
However you frame that in your own life.
Right.
Good conversation, Chris.
Love to be in conversation with you, Shana.
Tell our listeners what's coming up before we bail out.
I have no idea what's coming up.
Are we going to our summer programming?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Yes, this is our last show of the program year. We'll go into summer replay, so you'll hear some of the best conversations from the past year. Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light.
Thank you, listeners, once again for tuning in. Thank you to our generous donors on Patreon. You guys make this show possible. You make the work of the S1 Project possible. We cannot thank you enough. If you are a regular listener of this show and you would like to become a supporter of it, you too can do so. Just go to Patreon and sign up to be a regular contributor. We would be very grateful for anything you can throw in the proverbial bucket. The digital bucket.
The digital tip jar. Shana, I love being in conversation with you. Very grateful for our conversation today.
Always a blessing, Chris. Take care, everyone.